I don't know that I should have told you, but I needed you to know. Do you have enough data to freak out?
Yes.
Follow-up question. Will freaking out be helpful? I have yet to find a circumstance where the answer to that is yes. Even in dire situations. Even like in call 911 situations. You know, when you talk to EMTs, they'll tell you, worst case scenario, I've got someone on the other line that's completely freaked out. And so calm is this really interesting process of breathing, and you'll lose 50% of crazy in the breathing process, because what they're banking on is energy coming back. And so if you can hold space for a minute, it's not a long time. Again, it feels like eternities for some of us, but just the, So I'm not clear on what's happening. Exactly what did you hear? You know, this is diffusing things by the second. And the interesting thing about grounded theory research is that when we write down what's happening, what's been interesting is to let calm people to see this and say, oh my God, that's exactly what I did do. I had no idea. Because a lot of times we bring to light processes that people aren't even aware that they're engaged in. But when calm people come and validate, that's exactly what I do. I ask tons of questions, and then I try to figure out if getting upset is going to be helpful. And it's just not. But calm is the superpower. And I love this quote, and I don't know where it came from. I think the urban myth is that Oprah has this on her door, or had it on her door at Harpo. But I think it's a great quote, and it is, you are responsible for the energy you bring into this room. Yeah, and we have it in our house. You're responsible for the energy that you bring into this room. And so I think calm is taking responsibility for the energy that you're putting back out in really difficult situations. And so I defined calm. I know y'all will be surprised, because I didn't like the definition. And it just didn't fit, you know, it didn't fit with the data. And so that's my first litmus test, because I have to, as a researcher, have something that fits with the data. So I simply define calm as creating perspective and mindfulness while managing emotional reactivity. I really think calm is ultimately about managing emotional reactivity. And imagine the emotions that make us the most reactive. Shame and fear. Vulnerability. So calm is, you know, when Ellen comes home from school and says, Jody took my book, rip the pages out of it, and then flip me off. Welcome to middle school, in case y'all are not parenting someone in middle school. My first response is rage, protection. Jody, who? Spell the last name. Yeah, because I'm already having this conversation in my head with Jody's mother. And so calm. And if we want our kids to keep coming back and telling those stories and sharing their experiences, we have to manage our reactivity. You know, which a lot of times for me is, wow, that's hard. Just a moment. I got to really pull myself together here. I got to hear about this. I really am, but I have to take a minute here. And I'm really honest with her. I'm like, I don't want to react to this, but I'm having a hard time. She's like, I know, it's really hard. I was like, okay, well, let's sit down. Let's talk about exactly what happened. And that's where I depend on questions. Where were you? Like, I don't really care where she was. But I need to know the whole story. And it gives me a time to understand more. Where were you? Who is she? I haven't heard you talk about her. What book? Yeah, I'm fact-finding, you know, but I'm also calming down. All right, let's go to the next one. Cultivating meaningful work, letting go of self-doubt, and supposed to. The last two guideposts were two of the trickiest. The last one, we'll laugh when we get there. The idea of creating meaningful work. The best way I can talk about this is that men and women who are wholehearted do work that they care about. They feel a sense of purpose and passion around their work. Let me tell you what that does not mean. That does not mean that they go to the jobs every day that they have that pay for their mortgage or their rent and their cars and their groceries and feel deep meaning and purpose around that work. What that means is if they do have jobs every day that pay the bills, that they don't feel deep purpose and meaning around. They do other things in addition to that. And there's a great book. It's not in print anymore, which is unfortunate. I reference it a lot in here. I saw her speak and I got very interested because it fits so much with my data. And it's called The Slash Career. And she talked about people, a longshoreman who was also a documentary filmmaker, a rabbi who was also a rapper, an accountant who was also a jeweler. So one of the things I saw in my work around the wholehearted is that a lot of them either had full-time careers that were very meaningful for them. They loved what they did. They found passion and purpose in what they did. Or they had slash careers. And I remember speaking to someone once, and this story is in The Gifts, where she gave me a pair of earrings. And I said, "You're an amazing jeweler. I love these." And she said, "I'm not really a jeweler. I'm an accountant. I'm a CPA." And I said, "Well, I'm wearing your earrings." And she's like, "Yeah, but I don't make money doing that. I mean, I don't make that much. This is my career as I'm an accountant." And I said, "But you're also a jeweler." She said, "I am a jeweler." And I said, "So you're an accountant and you're a jeweler." And she said, "I am an accountant and a jeweler, but I don't ever say that because we only get to be what makes money." And I think that's a real problem in our culture. There are a small number of people who have managed to be able to feed their souls and feed their families on their work. But there are a lot more people who have found a way to do something they love or be a part of something they love that's driven by purpose and meaning in addition to work that they have. And for a lot of people like her, I didn't ask her this, but certainly that's creativity. And I would imagine for her, it's play. I mean, how many of you are familiar with Etsy? So for those of you who are not, Etsy.com, it's a place where you can sell your homemade wares. If you're a jewelry person, if you knit socks and scarves, if you sell paintings, photographs. And the interesting thing about the Etsy demographic is the majority of people who sell their goods on Etsy have full-time employment that is not related to what they're selling on Etsy. But they have found a way to cultivate meaningful work in what they do. Another great example of this are the people who volunteer. You know, yes, all day. I am a lawyer. And there's some purpose in that and there's some meaning, but mostly it's a really great job and I'm good at it. But what I really love is I run the Habitat for Humanity project for my corporation. What I think is really important is that we find a way to cultivate meaningful work in our lives. The gremlin there is letting go of supposed to. You know, work is supposed to suck. You're supposed to be miserable. And I don't think we have to find our entire, you know, buffet of joy and happiness at work. I don't. And I love what I do. I mean, I really love what I do. But some of it's just hard. I mean, I just turned in a book and let me tell you, that is like, I don't know, I think it was Emily Dickinson that said like, cut your vein open and tweeze every word out of your, you know, blood or something. Whatever it was not graphic enough to describe the process for me. Like I can't stand it. It's horrible. I mean, can you imagine? You have to write in total isolation. You realize that, right? And I write about connection in total isolation. All I can tell you about writing for me is that how many of you have done the tour at Alcatraz with the audio? Okay, it's the best tour, isn't it? It's incredible. So you go through the Alcatraz. If you go to San Francisco, it's not cheesy. It's so great. So you go to Alcatraz, you take the tour, you wear this audio, and the people narrating it are former guards and prisoners. Oh, it's just, but one of the things that they say that was so heartbreaking for me was that on New Year's Eve and those kind of nights, they were in their cells and they could hear the music and the laughter from San Francisco. That's how I feel when I'm writing. This is why I'm telling this story. Because I am locked away in my study and I hear my children laughing and I hear Steve like laughing with them and they're cooking dinner and I'm like, therefore, comma, you know. So there are parts of my work that I hate. How many of you have parts of your work that you intensely dislike? Alcatraz-y dislike. Right. I mean, yeah. Yeah. But I also find incredible meaning in my work. And so if you're on the fence about if you have the ability to feed your soul and feed your family or feed yourself with work you love, it's worth whatever you have to do to make that happen. It's really worth that leap. If you don't have that option, it is absolutely worth a leap of finding a way to express yourself and work in some contribution that reflects who you are. And you have the right to do that, even if you don't make any money and you have to carve away time from the rest of your life to do it. If you want to make candles and sell them on Etsy, we have the right to say, you know what? I'm sorry, kids, I can't do that tonight. Tonight's candle making out in the garage. I've got to get 4 new candles on Etsy. And this is a huge issue between partners. And then your partner looks at you and says, you sell those candles for $10. I'll give you $40. Come back in the house. Really? I mean, you talk about men and women who are trying to cultivate these careers, and they're judged on what we talked about, productivity, money. And it's not about the $40, right? It's about the, you know, you keep the $40. Oh, actually, buy me some dinner with the $40 and bring it out to the garage, because I'm going to be making my candles. Because this is a part of who I am and how I express myself. You know, and we get to ask for that. We get to say, no, this is not play for me. This is my work. I'm a candle maker. And I get to make 4 of these a month. And I'm going to make them. And I need you to honor and respect that, because it's part of who I am. And we have the right to ask for that. And we have to let go of the gremlin that says, you're only supposed to do things that make money. You're not supposed to take time away from other people to do things that are frivolous and not revenue generating, that don't make sense, that are flaky or artsy. Or, you know, I told my motorcycle club I was going to do the books for them. I'm the treasurer for the motorcycle club. Oh, my God, you and your motorcycle club. You know, come on. You're a landscaper. You're not an accountant. You don't need to do the books. It's part of my work. It's important to me. I love riding with these guys. I'm the treasurer. I'm going to go do my books. It's important. It's part of who we are. The last one, guidepost number 10, cultivating laughter, song, and dance, and letting go of cool and always in control. So this manuscript went in without this guidepost. My doctoral student, Yolanda, was like, what happened to the data on laughing and singing and dancing? I was like, well, I don't know that that was very persuasive. And she said, it was as persuasive as meaningful work and calm and the rest of it. I'm like, I wasn't persuaded. She's like, well, that's freaking irrelevant. It's like, what do you mean? She goes, you know you can't do that. And you know that you probably called me and asked me to look at this specifically because you knew I was going to tell you that you can't do that. And don't put in the acknowledgments and Yolanda Villarreal, who made me put in this last piece, because I don't believe in it. I was like, I am, you know, the man in the arena, right? I'm showing up. I'm talking about vulnerability. I'm talking about spirituality. Don't make me do something on laughter, song, and dance. And then she looks and says, well, if you feel like that's your wholehearted decision, yeah, then you do what you need to do. I'm like, damn you. Laughter, song, and dance. People are like, yeah, incredibly important. And what is the gremlin that we have to let go of in order to fully embrace laughter, song, and dance? Looking foolish. What else? Being judged. What else? You're not good at that. Insecurity.
You may enjoy yourself.
Oh, you may enjoy yourself. Then you'd be really goofy. So this is where we're going to get a little interactive. Okay. So what I'm going to ask you all to do is stand up. So if you're listening at home by yourself, I'm expecting that you're standing up. Okay, so you're extras in my movie. And what I'd like for you to do is face the other side so you see each other. So when I say action, we're going to start with laughter. I would like for you to laugh as hard as you can and joyfully as you can until I say cut. Okay, ready? Action. Okay, cut. Awesome. Great. Okay, now we're going to move on to sing. Again, watching each other across the aisle. We're ratcheting it up a little bit on the vulnerability scale. Okay, so I'm going to start you off, and then you're going to finish. You ready? Bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Awesome. Wasn't that fun, actually? Yeah. Okay. So then last one. I know. The highest on the vulnerability. The only thing after this, after dance in terms of vulnerability, would be naked. And Sounds True won't let me do it. So when I say action, I want you to dance. But the focus is on dancing. So if you have to only tap into one creative thing... So at home, you should be embarrassed for us, A, but also participating. Okay, ready? Bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I... Cut. Give yourself a hand. Wait, stay up. Hold on. Good. Okay, no, it's not over yet. Okay, again, facing across so you can see each other. When I say action, what I want you to do is strike a pose that says, I'm cool and I'm in total control of the situation. So let me give you a minute to get serious. You're backed into a corner. You're in a difficult place, work, home, PTO, community. And you need to strike a pose that basically says, I'm cool and I'm in control. Don't jack around with me. You ready? Go. I want you to hold this pose for a second. And I want you to look and see, without moving too much, what the people across from you are doing. Okay. All right. So let's sit down. Good job. Let's give each other a hand. Okay. Okay. So... the reason why I do this exercise is I think it's really important for this reason. This is in the emotional neurobiology of our bodies. This is exactly how cool works. When you laughed, you moved a lot. Some people on that end were really moving. Woohoo! Ha ha ha! Laughing, moving. When you sang, you moved. Bye-bye, Miss America. Then when I said, had you dance, you really danced and sang. Then when I asked you to strike a pose that said cool and in control, what did you do? That's exactly how emotions work. Cool is an emotional straitjacket. It prevents emotional growth and movement. It's exactly how it works. It's the only reason why I put you through this, because it's a powerful way of thinking about it, right? So let me describe for the people listening and show what I saw in most of you. There were a few who did not want to play along, so you struck the same pose during all four. I get that. And let me just tell you, if I were in the audience 5 years ago and someone said, let's stand up, we're going to do something, I'd be like, all right, I have to go to the restroom. I would have never participated. Now I'd be doing it for sure, because... I'm better at that stuff than I used to be. But this is what the majority of what most of you look like. Arms were folded across your chest. You had one foot out, and you had a very stern look on your face. No vulnerability, no openness, completely self-protected, and completely closed down, shut down, disengaged, right? That's how cool works. And cool is really dangerous. Never in my life did I think, interviewing the adult population only for the majority of the time, that I would be talking about cool. If I was, a youth researcher or something, I would think that's huge. I don't care whether you're 18 or 88. Being cool, hip, relevant, super important. How many of you come from families of origin where cool was important? Like, I come from a family where cool was very important. Like, what you didn't want to do if you were fishing was, like, use the wrong lure. We learned very quickly to assess the situation, like social observe, understand what the norms are, and then jump right in and be better at everybody at it. You know, so like in Texas, you're driving, you pass somebody, like there's two ways to drive. You either go 100 miles an hour on the fast lane or you stay over here. And when you want to get around someone, you wave and you wave back. And if you don't do that, we just shoot you off the road. You know, I mean, really. People who come to Texas are like, oh my God. And our signs, our streets, our speed limit signs actually say, don't mess with Texas. Like, that's our slogan. Well, very welcoming. But I was raised in a family where cool was very important. In fact, it was more important in some senses than even safety. If you did some really wild things as a teenager, that was okay as long as you had a good story at the end of it. Does that make sense? So let me tell you, one of the most dangerous things we hand down to our kids today is the emphasis on cool. That it's really important what other people think of you. That it's really important that you fit in. Way more important than belonging. And that you know exactly how to act and you always seem in control. The shame trigger for women for laughing and dancing is, hey, whoa, slow down. How does that feel for y'all when I say that? Don't laugh too loud. Don't take up too much room. Don't be obnoxious. Settle down now. How does that feel? Like crap, doesn't it? The shame trigger for men, well, if weakness is the number one elicitor, the shame trigger for men, too much laughing, singing, and dancing is out of the question, right? There's something in the Gifts of Imperfection where a guy said, I love to dance, but I'm not a very good dancer. So my girlfriend says, I'm going to dance with so-and-so. You sit this one out. Because she's embarrassed about how I dance in front of her friends. And the guys in here are going, yeah, this happens. And so one of the things I think it's really important in our houses, and whether it's just us or us and our partner, us or partner kids, is we have a goofy rule. Like, how many of you are comfortable being silly or goofy in front of other people? A few, yeah. Oh my God. Like, that's very uncomfortable for me. And for how many of you are very uncomfortable being silly and goofy in front of people? For a lot of us, it's really hard, and it's about trust, and it's about vulnerability. It's like the story, the first story I told you about Ellen dancing. And so I think what we have to have in our homes are rules where we can be as goofy and playful and laugh as loud and dance as much. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the Gifts of Imperfection is I can measure the wellness of our family by how much dancing is happening in the kitchen. We dance a lot as a family in the kitchen, sock-footed to really bad music like Vanilla Ice. And I've been known to break into the Running Man on more than one occasion. I'm actually pretty good at it. And I can, what's it called? Moonwalk. I can. My kids are super impressed. To be goofy, to let ourselves laugh and dance and sing. It's the Mark Twain quote. Dance like no one's watching, sing like no one's listening, love like you've never been hurt, and live like it's heaven on earth. And to me, that's vulnerability, right? So our last one, we'll go back to wholehearted and kind of close with the idea that I think putting these guideposts into practice is a lot of work. And I think of wholeheartedness like the North Star. You don't ever get there. You just know when you're headed in the right direction, right? I clearly am still working on it every day. I mean, one of the stories that I tell in the Gifts of Imperfection is probably one of my most proudest parenting moments. And it happened in Nordstrom. And I was feeling really gross, really ugly, really had a sweatsuit on. My hair was dirty. I had to run and get some makeup. I was leaving for a trip. And Ellen said, I'm going to go, you know, can I go with you? And I'm like, that'd be great, sweetie, come on. I'm just going to run in and run out. We get there. She's like, hey, I've got the shoes that Grammy bought me in the back of the car. Can I exchange them while I'm here? Because they're too small. And I was like, oh God, I don't want to be in Nordstrom. And okay, let's do it. And so we ride the escalator up to the children's shoe department and we get to the top of the escalator and I look up and I see literally three of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life. I swear to you, it was like Charlie's Angels. I'm not kidding. They had skinny, skinny jeans, really high pointy boots, long, beautiful hair. They were all kind of standing, laughing together, and their daughters were in the shoe department. They were equally awesome. And Ellen and I, you know, kind of walked over and I was like, oh God. And the children's shoe department's right here and the children's department's right here at our store. And they were playing a song and I'm like doing something, trying to look busy and keep my head down. I'm just feeling small. You know that feeling where you're like, I should have stayed at home. And I see something out of the corner of my eye. And at first that kind of scared me because it was like, I thought like a wolf or something, like a jerky movement. Really, I was like, and I look over and it's Ellen. And she's listening to this music that's coming from the children's department. And she is full blown into her new dance obsession, which is the robot. The three mothers have put down what they're holding. And the young girls, their daughters who are there with, you can tell are right on the verge of laughing or saying something. Cause she's just doing it. Like, and just her way, not the way, but her way, you know, her robot way. And she kind of is like here and she looks up and she sees them staring and she looks over at me. And this was the moment, right? This was the moment because my default, the way I was parented probably, and my default would be like, geez, L, be cool, man. Pull it together. You know? But this is how wholeheartedness works. In the back of my mind, there was a voice that said, before we get crying. Sorry. No, it just said, don't betray her. She's laughing and singing and dancing. You know? Don't betray her. Be on her side.
Did you moonwalk?
I did not moonwalk. I did, however, bust into the robot with her. Yeah, I did. And I said, you know, I just looked at her and I said, awesome moves. And I didn't go right into the robot willingly. And she said, right? This is the perfect song. And I said, it is. And she goes, show me that scarecrow thing again, you do. And I'm like, huh? She said, show me the scarecrow. I'm like, okay. So I'm showing her this thing and she's like, I love that, right? I'm like, yes. You know, and they literally kind of pull their daughters close and like, were afraid of us. But I think that's how wholeheartedness works. You know, I think they're just moments and we're going to screw up as many of those as we get them right. And I think wholeheartedness is not getting it right, but then getting in the car when we do it wrong and say, you know, stopping the car and pulling it over and pulling, you know, getting out of the car and getting in the back seat and saying, I looked at you and I told you to pull it together, but what you were doing was awesome. And I was being weird and I was worried about what people would think. And I don't care what anyone in there thinks, but you. And I think you rock and I'm sorry. And I've had that conversation with her too. Trust me, both of my kids. I think wholeheartedness is subversive. I don't think it's the way the rest of the world is living. And I think we're going to bump up against some hard things when we say no, or we take on something, or we insist on making candles in the garage. I think it's going to bump up against some hard stuff and we have to decide. Yes, wholeheartedness is hard. But not fully living our lives is much harder. And much more dangerous. So I'll close with this quote. This is the quote that is really the heart of the new book, Daring Greatly. And I love it, from Theodore Roosevelt. It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes up short again and again, who at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly. And I think when we get to the door of that arena, whether it's, you know, popping and locking at Nordstrom, you know, or our work, or, you know, telling someone we love them when we're not sure they love us back, you know, going to a doctor and saying, this is where I'm struggling. I think we don't want to pull the handle of the arena and walk in unless we know everything's going to work out well. And, you know, we've spent a lot of time together, so I won't bullshit you and tell you that it's always going to work out, because it's not. You can get kicked around. And it's going to be hard sometimes, and it's hard for me sometimes. But in the end, it's why we're here. It's to show up, let ourselves be seen, and to dare greatly. And to really try to love and support each other as we do that. And I don't think there's gifts better than that. So thank y'all very much.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.